BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the process to elect a FIFA president is underway, with both candidates making a final plea for votes. Challenger Prince Ali bin Al Hussein promised to establish transparency and restore respect for world football's governing body if elected. Mr Blatter told the Congress he accepts responsibility for the corruption storm and wants time to put it right. Enda Brady's in Zurich and has been listening to Mr Blatter's speech.
As far as he's concerned, he wants the delegates to stick with him and to basically keep going with me. That is his message.
A 19-year-old's been sentenced for grooming a young man with learning difficulties to attack a soldier, mimicking the murder of Lee Rigby. The plot never came to fruition. Qazi Islam from Newham in East London will serve 8 years in a young offenders institute. The mother of two British children killed on a Thomas Cook holiday in 2006 has criticised a planned charity donation by the company's former boss. Harriet Green is to give a third of an upcoming share payout to a good cause, chosen by the parents of Bobby and Christy Shepherd. But Sharon Wood claims she's only doing it to win public support and says her family had virtually no notice of the decision.
We only heard about her decision on Wednesday afternoon and before we had a chance to discuss it as a family. Her statement was then released to the media. Yet again, it appears to us that our family are secondary, despite the fact that our children are at the heart of this.
Staff at steel giant Tata voted overwhelmingly in favour of strike action in a row over pensions. The company wants to extend workers' retirement age from 60 to 65. The United States has taken another big step in restoring its diplomatic ties with Cuba. Washington's announced it's removed the country from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message. I love you. Now, back to our show.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM
93.2. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's UKIP councillor for Hengrove, Michael Frost. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Cuba, the Palestine connection, well, is there one? Jackie Cannon used to work as a translator for the Cuban national newspaper, and Aristides Rodriguez is a health writer and researcher from Cuba. They're in town and are doing a talk in a few weeks' time, so we get a sneak preview. Also, with the West and the FBI crying corruption, trying to get their Sandhurst trade Jordanian general in as president of FIFA, we ask, is there no international institution the West's people don't want to take over? We dip into a recent internet documentary also called Invisible Empire to ask, what is the New World Order? Does it really exist? And why do so many point to the root of the problem being around the assassination of JFK back in 1963? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16, cloudy on Saturday, wet and windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, wet and windy and cooler at the beginning of the week. Warm and sunny weather, though, towards the end. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of June, it's highs of 23, mainly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So So helping us review this week's news, it's a UKIP councillor for Hengrove, Michael Frost. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, everybody.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself, Michael. You're a relative newcomer on the scene. You were elected last May, weren't you, as the first and only so far UKIP councillor on Bristol City Council. What's your background?
That's absolutely right. I've just done my first year as a new councillor and enjoyed every minute of it. My background is basically in sales and financial services, and I've been politically active for at least 30 years. I was an ex-chairman of Long Ashton Conservatives when Blair fought Hague. But after that, I realised that I didn't have anybody to vote for anymore, so UKIP came along and their policies suited my political vision.
Now, what you're effectively saying is that you kind of lost faith in the Conservatives at that point. Why was that?
Because I didn't agree with Europe, really, was the main thing, and I never have done. You know, I'm old enough to remember the first ever, or the only ever time we got to make a referendum, and I voted against it then, because I could only see it as folly being involved with so many European countries that have spent the last 300 years squabbling amongst themselves. I never ever saw that the whole thing could work together, and sadly, or not sadly, we've been proved absolutely right.
Well, it's interesting because some people like John Redwood, Bill Cash would agree with you, but they've stayed within the Conservative Party. Aren't you actually stronger within there if you want real change?
No, because you just become one voice of many. John Redwood is a very leading Eurosceptic, and there are a few others, but I wanted my own voice and I wanted my own little act to play in the whole thing, and that's what I've done, and I don't regret it one bit.
But I mean, some Conservative constituency associations, I'm thinking particularly of Marlborough, who we've had a couple of people from there up here over the years, they're staunchly anti-European, but they're still their own Conservative association. I mean, did you find that there was actually quite a lot of pressure from above on you at Long Ashton to say, well, no, you can't actually express your views?
That's a good question. I can only answer it with yes and no, really, because there was a very tight group of people that were very, very anti-European, and they were also part of the Hang'em, Shoot'em and Flog'em set, which was on the far right of the Tory party, which I wasn't on. My main gripe really has always been Europe and the fact that we are now not a nation that's governing ourselves. We are being governed by a bunch of faceless, unelected bureaucrats in Brussels, and that's what I will try with every bone in my body to stop.
Well, I have to agree with you to a certain extent, because just yesterday there was a very important vote on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is this deal across the Atlantic, which is going to effectively mean that big companies, multinational corporations, can take governments to court if they pass laws which affect their profitability and win, and so they're effectively vetoing a general election vote on an issue can then be vetoed in the courts by a big corporation, and yet there's hardly any coverage of that.
No, well, I think there is a conspiracy amongst the big corporate entities to actually keep the lid on this because it benefits them. And you are right, actually, Tony, that this should be made a lot more known to the general public, because I'm absolutely certain, I certainly realised when I was canvassing, that if you actually question a passerby on what they know and understand about it, they know nothing. Most people know absolutely nothing about this. And it's an absolute scandal, because it will affect massively every walk of our life where it comes to healthcare.
Well, it is affecting already, isn't it, Europe in a wider sense? But old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is just one example of the power of Brussels now, the decisions being made in Brussels which affect us, and yet actually there's not really proper scrutiny and coverage, and the public aren't being informed about these things.
Well, I don't think it's just the public. I think the mainstream politicians, at the leaders of the parties, don't have, it's all being negotiated in secret, and then they're going to present us supposedly with a final deal which nobody's seen, not even the politicians, and they're just going to try and railroad it through. And I think it's interesting, because Nigel Farage was on two sides of the fence on this one. because he's against, if it came from Europe, he'd be against it. But if Britain were negotiating directly with the US, then he might be in favour of it. But I think, you know, you sound as if you've got the right attitude from my point of view, which secret deals are just not on. We need to know what's in them, and everybody should debate what's in them, especially if they're going to change fundamental things like taking governments to court for their own, for their elected policies.
You're absolutely right. And if Nigel Farage was sitting here now, he would agree with everything that you've just said, because one thing that he is vehemently against, and that is, you know, closed doors negotiating, big businesses, corporate entities all clubbing together. You know, it will be the downfall of it could possibly spell the downfall of our National Health Service.
This is also an example with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. I remember seeing, this is about 8 months ago, actually a group of MEPs, our elected MEPs, with a crowbar breaking into a room where secret negotiations were going on in order to find out and report back to their constituents who'd elected them what was going on. Now, that surely is not democratic, and that's the way things seem to work at Brussels. Just one thing yesterday, the vote yesterday in the European Parliament was about this TTIP trade agreement. It's the committee, the EU's trade committee, passed it, actually including a deal on the controversial investor-state dispute settlement, Martin.
Well, what was the political split on it?
The article here is, if you want to just explain a bit more about it, I can figure that out. But this is a subcommittee of the European Parliament.
Yeah.
The panel, it says, voted 29-10 for this amendment, which settles to use the ISDS reform proposal pitched by Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström as a basis for a permanent solution for resolving disputes between investors and states.
Well, what I was interested in was who were the 10 opposing MEPs and which parties did they come from?
But let's think, is not the whole of the European Parliament. This is just a small committee making this decision.
Well, I think that the mainstream political leadership, both in the US and in Europe, didn't know that this thing existed until about 18 months ago. So this thing has been negotiated for years and years and years in secret, and then they suddenly pop out and say, we've been negotiating this for years in secret, and now the political level can know what's happening. And most of the political level have not been involved in the negotiation. They didn't even know it was taking place.
That's right.
If that's not wrong, I don't know what is.
Those who voted against it and have been very vocal in criticising it, although I haven't heard them, is the Greens and the left-wing MEPs who've blasted the outcome. Anyway, look, this is just one example of Europe. What would you like to see, in this whole... because I mean, you can't just leave Europe, because we have a very important trade agreement with the whole of the EU.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of scaremongering thing that we hear time and time again. We are quite happy. Let's just state the fact, because one thing that's going to happen as this whole debate starts to roll out, with Cameron flying around all over Europe trying to renegotiate our deal on Europe, it's pathetic. He can't do that. He can make some noises. He might have the Dutch agree with him and one thing and another. But to change the policies to the way that he will have to, if he wants to silence the right of the Tory party and bring the majority of the country on side, is that we have to leave before we can get any real negotiations with Europe. And the way that has to be done is by invoking Article 50 of the Treaty of Lisbon, because they won't take us seriously until we're about to walk out and close the door behind us. Cameron knows that, and he's playing the general public for fools. My big worry, and it links into what we was talking about earlier about deals being done, you know, in closed rooms and what have you, is that the same kind of thing will start to appear with the Yes campaign, because a lot of big business and politicians want to stay in Europe because it's the gravy train and they want to keep their snouts firmly rammed into it. And unless we have a clear, honest debate about the benefits of coming out, the benefits of coming out is that we can trade with the world. We can become a member of the World Trade Organization. Europe buys a lot of goods and services from us. you know, and all these people that say, oh, well, aerospace is going to pack up and Nissan are going to pack up and Honda is going to take their plant out of Swindon and all this. All they're trying to do is scare the public into thinking that without Europe, we are useless and we are alone, and nothing more can be the case.
Well, Martin keeps reminding us about Norway and their position, because they're not part of the European Union.
Look how they're thriving.
Yeah, incidentally, we're already a part of the WTO. Mm. I mean, we just are.
We don't have a seat at the table.
No, but I mean, that's because...
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, the Norwegians have long, you know, they've been offered to join the EU many a time, but they've got a, you know, fairly strong Labour tradition in Norway, although they've moved to the right recently, and they just saw the EU as too corporate dominated, basically.
Too corrupt as well. But you're talking about an organisation that's never, ever had its books audited. How many big companies or conglomerates?
Well, you know what? It reminds me of another organisation that refuses to have its books audited. That's the Federal Reserve in the United States, the private bank that runs the dollar, basically.
Yeah. Can I just say something else about Norway? What you've got to understand, though, the Norwegians pay more per head into the EU budget than we do, because that's the quid pro quo for not having a tariff wall against their exports. Mm. So, I mean, they're prepared to do that. They'd rather be out and pay to be out.
So they're paying the money for the trade deal, but they're not interested in the political union.
Well, the point is that they if you don't do that, then they'll put up a trade barrier against you. So in other words, you know, there would be a significant economic impact. But in any case, in other words, the idea that we're going to save money from, you know, the money that we spend on the EU budget, that money was probably going to have to be spent even if we left the EU, because that's the sort of deal you have to do. But for the Norwegian point of view, they think it's money well spent to stay out.
But currently, we're burning £54 million per day to be a member of this corrupt, inept organisation. Yeah,
but the point I'm making is you'd still have to pay that money over, even if you were outside, as Norway and Switzerland are. They have to pay for the privilege of staying out.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Switzerland, Martin, because it's all happening, isn't it? With this vote is now, I'm just looking at the BBC website, the FIFA presidential election is underway right this minute as it's all happening. And Tuesday we had the shock announcement, didn't we? In fact, I think it was Wednesday morning, possibly, the arrest of seven executives from FIFA. Let's just ask the pair of you what you make of this. Maybe Michael Frost from UK Independence Party, Bristol councillor. What do you make of it?
You couldn't make it up, as a lot of people say. I mean, this is just the most amazing thing. You know, so half of or nearly all of the senior FIFA officials and vice presidents all get their collars felt by the FBI, and then Sepp Blatter stands up and does the Gorlick shrug and says, well, I didn't know anything about this. Does anybody out there with half a brain believe this corrupt little man? I mean, he's had 40 years.
Just a minute, hang on.
In this organisation.
The FBI, why are the FBI involved? This is an organisation based in Switzerland. And what are the FBI doing, feeling people's collars in Europe, in Switzerland?
Well, they're uncovering a fraud, aren't they? And that's what it is. You know, they had one of their analysts some time ago carry out an in-depth investigation into FIFA, because this is an organisation that's been tainted with fraud accusations for years and years.
A bit like the International Olympic Committee, isn't it?
Well, okay. I mean, that's a separate issue. Let's stay on this one, because this one is just 10 times bigger than that. You know, who was watching the TV that night when they awarded the World Cups to Qatar? Now, the whole country's jaw must have just dropped open. Because how this nothing little country in the middle of the desert, it isn't a footballing nation. How the hell did they get awarded that?
Just a
if
minute.
It wasn't
hang
brown
a minute.
Envelopes but, flying about.
Hang on. United States is not a footballing nation. What are their FBI doing getting involved in all this then?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't, you know, this is a bit
You're asking
it's
me
not American football, is it?
Well, I think the timing is very interesting, because it's just
2 days before the presidential election.
And I think Putin's already said something about this, because he said, well, this is the Americans basically using, you know, extraterritorial powers.
Well, it's about legal jurisdiction, isn't it?
Legal
So the FBI's legal jurisdiction stops when you leave the coast of the United States.
Well, I mean, they've obviously managed to persuade Swiss prosecutors to go along with what they've said.
Well, they've presented evidence
to the
Swiss. It's
a bit rich coming from Putin as well, isn't it?
Well, what's happened is the FBI presented evidence to the Swiss police and the Swiss have acted.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason I mentioned Putin is because the 2018 World Cup is going to be in Moscow.
Yeah.
So, of course, there is the implication, and I'm inclined to go along with this, is that the Americans are trying to create further problems for Putin in relation to this World
Cup.
We could also look
at the alternative candidate that people will be voting for, but they probably are right this minute, which is this guy Prince Ali from Jordan. Now, I had a little look into this guy. Well, he's a general in the Jordanian army. Jordan is an absolute monarchy, and they have a very, very close relationship with NATO and the West. They were training some of the Syrian rebels, who are now called ISIS, who are running around like crazy, and also he was trained at Sandhurst.
Well, you can see this is shaping up as an east-west confrontation.
It's a shame, isn't it, don't you think, Michael, to see the potential anyway here of politics being dragged into, you know, one of the most important sporting organisations in the world.
I agree with you, but somebody once said, you know, where there is money, there is fraud, and what do you do about it? But it's just got so much out of control now. I mean, this sort of thing has always gone on, and blind eyes have been turned. And Blatter is a very, very slick operator because he's built his power base basically by bribing smaller nations all over the world and helping them set up their academies and whatever. In some of these countries, he's almost a demigod. So that's where his power base is. And if he is, sadly, re-elected today, then that's where those votes will come from.
So, OK, because the election is going on right this second, what's your prediction, your crystal ball? Do you think he'll get back in or not? We should find out in the next half hour.
Really?
Hour or so.
My heart says I hope that Prince Ali gets in because he seems a pretty honest, stand-up guy. He's fabulously wealthy in his own right, so why should he really cover any sort of corruption? I hope Blatter doesn't get in. His time is gone. He's 79 years old. He will always be tainted with the corruption brush, irrespective of though he's trying at the moment to stand up and say, oh, well, you know, we got to fight this from the inside and all the rest of it. Does anybody believe him?
There's another important vote going on at the FIFA Congress, Martin, and that is over the possible expulsion of the Israeli Football Association for racism. There's a lot of Palestinian campaigners down at the Congress campaigning around that issue too. I wonder if you think there's any connection here.
Well, there may be. I mean, but it'd be silly of me to speculate. I frankly don't follow internal FIFA politics with such a close eye that I could really honestly give you an honest opinion about what's going on. As Michael says, corruption has always been there. I question the timing. Sepp Blatter, as you say, has been there 40 years, 79. You'd have thought he'd want to retire after all that sort of period. It doesn't seem rational for him to continue.
He's a megalomaniac.
Yeah, maybe.
That's the problem.
Maybe. I don't know enough about him to say, although I think what is definitely underpinning all of this is the neocons in the US will be looking to mess up the Moscow World Cup in 2018. They will once. I mean, Ukrainian Kiev has already called for a boycott of it. So we may end up with it, you know, like the 1980 Moscow Olympics with lots of people not turning up and so on.
As you just said, and I agree with you, I mean, I don't follow the internal workings of FIFA. In fact, everything I've learned about FIFA, I've learned in the last 24 hours,
yeah.
Right? As I think most people have, apart from the fact that it was well known that Blatter hates the British and would do anything he could to stop us getting the World Cup, which is probably what he did last time. But the FBI and Putin, and I mean, that is all real James Bond stuff. I don't know about that.
Well, on the Palestinian thing, because this is quite an important vote about the possibility of Israel being expelled from FIFA, the news just in the last hour or so is that the Palestinian Football Association has withdrawn its motion to suspend Israel from FIFA. So all the drama there is suddenly the vote isn't going to happen on that. But Martin, what's your prediction, Blatter or Ali? Who's going to win?
I haven't the faintest idea. I don't know who the electorate is or how the chips crumble, but I'm pretty certain certain that the FBI intervention is trying to influence the outcome. That's probably what.
And is it just literally just the timing, the 2 days before the election?
Yeah. I mean, things like that don't happen by accident.
Oh, of course not. No, I agree. I mean, that was all set up and timed. I'd like to see the other guy win, Prince Ali, because I think that will set the whole organisation off on a fresh new path. If Blatter does get re-elected, I did read that UEFA are looking to pull out from the World Cup. Now, if that did happen, there's no point in having a World Cup. If the big European team said, sorry, we don't want to play, with this organisation because of all the corruption, who are you left with? Israel? I mean, who are Israel as a football team?
Onto some of this week's news.
Long Ashton United there in
England too. Well, I wonder who would win. Oh, anyway, interesting competition, that one. The Queen's speech this week, the State Opening of Parliament, otherwise known as. So let's have a little listen now back to Parliament earlier this week and the Queen making her pronouncements about what's going to be in the legislative programme.
My Lords, pray be seated.
Mr. Speaker, the Queen commands this Honourable House to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
My Lords and members of the House of Commons, my government will legislate in the interests of everyone in our country. It will adopt a one-nation approach, helping working people get on, supporting aspiration, giving new opportunities to the most disadvantaged, and bringing different parts of our country together.
That's the first. We'll have divided it up into several clips. Martin, you first. Bringing the country together, that's the plan.
Yeah, well, as Harriet Harman said in a response to the Queen's speech, she doesn't think so, and nor do I.
Michael?
Well, I guess the Tories are taking the opportunity to rub the left's nose in all sorts of things at the moment. Bringing the country together, that remains to be seen. But I would look at it from the opposite angle and say, what on earth would the country, what on earth state would the country be in? Excuse me. If we'd have had Ed Miliband now as our Prime Minister and Ed Balls as our Chancellor. If you're talking about wanting to bring the country together, I think you'd be more worried about bringing the country down, because an absolute disaster, a tsunami of incompetence and financial problems would ensue. Well, we haven't got that situation.
Well, actually, there wasn't really a chance, was there, of Ed Balls being in place, Martin, because the voters saw to that.
Yes, incidentally, as I just said earlier before we came on air, if 3,000 Green voters had voted Labour in 10 constituencies, the Conservatives wouldn't have had a overall majority, and there would have had to have been some kind of negotiation.
Yeah, well, you could say the same Conservatives and if UKIP hadn't voted.
We can come back to the election itself in a moment. And the other thing is Ed Balls would still have had his seat. Ed Balls is a brainy guy. As far as I'm concerned, the problem with them is that they've not been sufficiently robust in tackling the fact that the banking system's insolvent. Nobody wants to talk about that. Everybody talks about the recovery, although that seems to be petering out. In actual fact, there's going to be a major financial crisis anyway, and it's probably better for Osborne to be holding the ball when the roof falls in.
Interesting. I don't actually think Ed Balls is a brainy guy. I think he's a total idiot, and he's driven by a left-wing ideology.
If you think Ed Balls is left wing, you're completely deluded. Ed Balls, in fact, is too far to the right on the economy. That's the problem with him.
Well, he's part of this Bilderberg organisation, isn't he? And in fact, it was at the last Bilderberg conference, which was in 2014, which was in Copenhagen, he actually couldn't get in. It's quite funny when they have all these big business people, the royalty, you've got the heads of all the biggest banks in the world.
That is a scary organisation.
Well, when Ed Balls turned up to that in Copenhagen, he didn't have the right piece of paper with him, and they wouldn't let him in, so he had to go around to several different entrances.
He certainly went in when we went to protest against them in Watford, did he not?
Yeah.
Along with
Osborne, Cameron went.
And also Lord
Shirley
Burnson.
Williams went. And she was one of the people very much behind the getting the Liberal Democrats to support the Health and Social Care Act, which is a bill which was about the privatisation of the health service. Yeah. Anyway, just before we go back to the Queen's speech, Michael, what are your thoughts about the results locally for UKIP, particularly in the general and local elections here?
Well, locally,
because you've got this interesting thing in Bradley Stoke, haven't you, where you've got several councillors there too who have defected from the Conservative Party like you did over to UKIP as well. I mean, that's to add to the whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, I never defected per se. I left the Conservative Party, and for a while I wasn't a member of any party, and then I decided to join UKIP. So I wasn't one of the, not that there's anything wrong with that, and all power to their elbow, but I wasn't one of those that's all of a sudden said, right, I'm a UKIPper. You know, I actually studied exactly what I thought was the right path to take, and that's why I did that. But to answer your question, we had the biggest swing in the southwest when our chairman went up against Karen Smythe in Bristol South. You know, we was never going to win it because it's going to take a while for, you know, our policies to really hit home with people.
Well, but that was a safe seat for Labour, wasn't it?
And so, it's always been Labour since Keir Hardie stood up on a soapbox. So, you know, it was a massive, massive thing to try and overturn. But on the other side, James McMurray nearly overturned the leader of the Labour group in Bristol, Helen Holland. She got her seat by roughly 500 votes.
Martin, you've got some explaining to do here, haven't you? Well, so it looks as if...
We all predict that she will make a chicken run to another safer seat in the next election.
Well, it looks like Labour, I mean, a lot of people were predicting that the UK Independence Party would be taking votes from the Conservatives and possibly Lib Dems, but particularly Conservatives. Looks certainly in Bristol as if quite a lot of those votes have gone from Labour, former Labour voters. So what has the Labour Party been doing wrong?
I think you've got, there's two things I'd say about that. There's lots of former Tory voters in Labour seats who have switched to UKIP. And there are also former Labour voters who switched to UKIP. I think UKIP did creditably in the election, but as we all know, they only got one MP. Sinn Féin got four. That's 400% more MPs who don't take their seats than the whole of UKIP. Now, that's not right, as Douglas Carswell said on election night. I don't think it's right. And I'm looking for the new Labour leader, whoever it is, to commit themselves to proportional representation, which is what the TUC and Francis O'Grady are suggesting what needs to be on the agenda. None of them have, because I'm afraid they're too far to the right.
But the Labour did surely slip up on immigration. They should have had a more decisive policy on it, and on the failure to back the European.
Labour didn't want to talk about it. We got hold of some literature that was sent out by the Labour Party that was supposedly only for Labour candidates, where, you know, if you're asked about immigration on the doorstep, move the conversation on to something else. They didn't want to talk about it.
Well, interestingly enough, the new Labour era, they were the ones, following Tory policy previously, that wanted to expand the EU as rapidly as possible to the east. The Germans and the French weren't very keen on that. They wanted to take it slowly. But the British pushed for rapid inclusion of East European countries, and I was used to work in those countries at the time, so I was aware of the debates around it. And then, of course, when the EU was expanded to the east, the Germans put a clause in which said that you don't have to take, we will move to full freedom of movement of labour, but only by stages. And each country was allowed to opt out of completely opening their borders immediately.
That's right. I know where you're going with this.
But of course, New Labour, too far to the right, agreed that they didn't want to take advantage of the opt-out.
And they
that was what they got wrong.
Yeah.
They got that wrong. So when the internal debate now in the Labour Party, where they're saying, oh, the problem is Miliband was too far to the left. No, he actually started to make up some of the ground on that, and we're going to have to look at that again. Mm. And of course, this all will come out in this debate, which we're now going to have, about the EU and what the rules and regulations are and so on. Okay. But can I just stress, the real problem is if Greece leaves the EU this week, the banking system will collapse, and we're talking about moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic.
Okay, so that this is a debate which will go on and on quite certainly right up until the...
Just before we move on, I've got some interesting, because I think I can sum this up, because we've both been talking about this evening, and I've got some interesting statistics that I prepared for this evening. So it's only one paragraph, so just bear with me. The Conservatives received just over a third of the vote share, 36.9%, but won 51%, 331 of the seats. The total turnout was 66.1%, so less than a quarter of the electorate voted for the Tories. Mm-hmm. First past the post was designed for a two-party system. We are now a five national parties with significant support. The two main party support are concentrated into areas, Labour in urban areas and northern England, the Tories in rural England and southern England. UKIP's support is spread throughout the length and breadth of England and Wales. Now this is the interesting bit. UKIP had nearly 3.9 million votes, 12.6% of the vote, but only got one seat in Parliament. The Green Party had only a million votes, which was 3.8% of the vote, and they in turn had one seat in Parliament. The Lib Dems got only 2.4 million votes, which was 7.9% of the vote, and they ended up, or retained, 8 seats in Parliament. Collectively, these three parties received 7.5 million votes, nearly a quarter of the total vote, but are represented by 10 MPs, which is less than 2%. In contrast, the SNP received only 1.5 million votes and have got 56 seats in Parliament. They received 50% of the vote share in Scotland, but 56 out of the 59 seats. Therefore, the SNP is totally over-representing their support.
Well, and many of the other parties are too. But, well, I mean, that's a fascinating way to look at it, isn't it? How many votes does it take to get one UKIP MP in our current system now?
Well, at the moment, 4 million.
Well, that is not right.
Of course it's not right.
It's not right.
Because
the system isn't... I mean, I argue on this programme, I've always argued, the system is broke. We need to change it.
Yeah.
Now,
we had a chance to change it at the last general election, and the public said no.
Yeah, the Liberal Party they should never have gone into coalition with the Tories, and they should never have agreed to that way of approaching it, because that's kind of killed it off. But I think it hasn't killed it off, because if you've got 4 million UKIP voters who think like Michael here, then it's not going to go away, is it?
It's not going to go away.
And I would argue, and Francis O'Grady of the TUC argues, that the time has come for us to reconsider this whole setup. Now, if we had a Liberal Democrat on here the other week,
Steve Comer,
and we went through the same figures, and from a sort of left versus right point of view, we measured it out. So if there'd been a proportional vote, who would have won? Now, in the Thatcher era, if you'd done that kind of proportional measurement, it was not clear that there was a mandate for a lot of the things that were done. Now, of course, if you put the UKIP vote together with the Tory vote, there is a 50.5% voted for UKIP or the Tories. Now, you could argue that a Tory majority in the teens is a fair reflection, just about, of the public mood across the country. Although in previous elections that wouldn't. This is by accident rather than by design. And as I say, if just 3,000 Green voters in 10 constituencies had voted Labour, that result would not have come about.
I agree. I think the reason the Tories ended up with a majority was at the last minute a massive amount of the public looked at Miliband and his policies and had a real oh my god moment, held their nose and voted Tory. The Lib Dem vote had totally collapsed because of Nick Clegg's lies, deceit and duplicity, call it whatever you like. So there's a big chunk of those votes that went into the E3L as well. But I've just got one other thing that...
Because we've got to get on, yeah?
This is really interesting, because this is talking about an alternative voting system, which we already use,
yeah.
Okay? Fairer voting systems have already been used in the UK for several years now, since 1999. This includes the Welsh Assembly, the Scottish Parliament, which is a mixture of first-past-the-post seats and regional top-up PR using the De Hond method, okay? And this is quite interesting. The European elections use De Hond on a regular basis. If we apply straight PR to the 11 constituencies...
This is proportional representation,
In the Greater Bristol area, This is what we would have come up with. UKIP had 67,000 votes, which would have been 11.96% of the vote and would have given us one MP. The Tories, 225,000, 39% of the vote, would have given them four MPs. Labour, 146,000, would have given them three MPs. Lib Dems, 77,000, two MPs. Greens, 49, which would have given them one MP. So applying that across the board does tend to even the whole thing out a bit.
Yeah, well, I think we've ended up with a right-of-centre government by accident. But, I mean, you're not happy with that because it's not your right-of-centre government. I would have,
and they've stolen our clothes on
I would have welcomed UKIP to be a much stronger force than the Tories, because UKIP are a new force with actually new ideas. They're not necessarily stuck on the right or the left. So for example, on things like foreign intervention, they tended to have views more similar to mine.
They want to do it.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, are we getting to a stage, Michael, where you think the whole idea of right and left is starting to dissolve and it's not quite as clear as it used to be?
Absolutely. I mean, one of my hustings speech was called Right, Left, Common Sense. And I came up with a whole load of issues which some would have seen as left, some would have seen as right, but in the middle was common sense. Now, that is where UKIP have scored massively. We are the party of common sense. We're not left-wing, we're not right-wing, we just look and listen to what the public want. And unfortunately, because of our voting system, millions of people have not, are now unrepresentative, and that makes me angry and very, very sad.
Martin, I mean, you're an old-fashioned left-wing party. You're okay, slowly but surely these new parties are going to be bulldozing over
well,
you.
Well, no, what will happen if you had PR is that the internal squabbles that we have in the Labour Party will be more easily resolved. In New Zealand, in the early 1980s, the left wing of the Labour Party and the trade unions forced PR because they had a Labour government, but it was pursuing Thatcherite policies, and the grassroots were not happy with it, and they knew the only way to get around that was to change the electoral system. So they went and knocked on every door in New Zealand. There's only 3 million people. Didn't take them long. They soon had a majority of people signed up to change the system. They had a vote on it. They changed it, and everything moved on. Now, what happens in New Zealand tends to happen in Britain with a time lag. They gave women the vote first in 1888. They started to build a welfare state in the 30s before we'd started here in Britain. Because think about the country that it is. It's people go there to get away from all
so
of
the... So when did they start dismantling the welfare state?
Well, they started dismantling it under the Labour government in 1980, but they got a reaction, and the reaction was to change the system. And Brian Gould, who's actually over there now, was deputy leader of the Labour Party in that era, and he was pointing us in the right direction. But of course, we didn't go in that direction, and then he's gone back to New Zealand. But we will go there.
Interesting history
sure.
lesson. Not sure quite how valid it is for today. But anyway, let's get back to the Queen, because she was in the driving seat in the House of Lords this week. Let's have a listen to the next part of her speech.
My government will continue with its long-term plan to provide economic stability and security at every stage of life. They will continue the work of bringing the public finances under control and reducing the deficit, so Britain lives within its means. Measures will be introduced to raise the productive potential of the economy and increase living standards. Legislation will be brought forward to help achieve full employment and provide more people with the security of a job. New duties will require my ministers to report annually on job creation and apprenticeships. Measures will also be introduced to reduce regulation on small businesses so they can create jobs. Legislation will be brought forward to ensure people working 30 hours a week on the national minimum wage do not pay income tax, and to ensure there are no rises in income tax rates, value-added tax, or national insurance for the next 5 years.
I'm quite happy for both of you to talk about whatever you want to do with what she's just been saying there. But Martin, the thing that jumped out to me was, I don't know if she was listening to our show last week, but this whole business of full employment. We had a really good discussion about that on the show last week, didn't we, about whether it's possible or not. And there's the Queen saying we will have full employment.
Well, I don't think full employment is possible in the current setup, as you know. I think what's interesting there is the whole thing about reducing the deficit, because I suspect that what will happen now is that Osborne is going to double down on the mistakes he made this time at the beginning of the last Parliament, and he'll put the brakes on too hard as the economy starts to weaken, and then the economy will flatline or collapse, and the deficit won't be decreased by thereby, it will actually go up. That's what is more than likely to occur, I think, possibly by the autumn.
Michael, for Councillor for UKIP.
I think that is real doom mongering, right? I don't actually think that'll happen, because the track record of the last government, although the Tories were hog-tied a little bit by the Lib Dems, you know, the economy has grown. We are on the mend. You know, Miliband couldn't talk about unemployment because it's down. He couldn't talk about the deficit because it was being put right. So, you know, we are on the right track. And as much as I would have loved to have seen 25, 30 UKIP MPs having an influence on this as well, I'm not unhappy about the way things are going to unfold. I don't think we can ever have full employment, because there is a huge tranche of people that are just unemployable, and we have to just carry them as part of being a caring socialist country. We just have to make sure that, you know, they can afford you know, their McDonald's and their PlayStations and whatever, and sit at home and do nothing.
Well, the thing is, that's not happening, is it? Because particularly with benefit sanctions, people having their benefits taken away for 6 weeks, 2 months, they can't even afford toilet paper, Michael.
Well, then they should find a job to do, because there are plenty of jobs to do. You know, all of these East European migrants that come over here, the one thing you can say about them is they all want to work, and they all want to come and do anything, really, to earn a living. Now, that creates a problem for our own unskilled workforce, because, you know, any of those sort of jobs that would be available are now being soaked up by migrants, and that's something that UKIP wanted to stop with immediate effect.
But, I mean, isn't this effectively, Martin, the one thing that the Labour Party just didn't get to grips with during the election campaign, the fact that economic migration is driving down wages and actually making it very difficult for people here to get a job if they're at the, you know, unskilled, maybe if they've been unemployed, long-term unemployed, it's becoming really, really difficult for these people genuinely to get work.
Well, I mean, if you could, you could have full employment in Britain, but you would have to actually massively expand the deficit, and you'd have to, and if you didn't want to do that, you'd have to raise taxes. You can have full employment, but then you potentially get inflation and so on. There's been an executive decision by everybody going back to 1979 that we're not going to have full employment. The bosses don't want full employment. They want a reserve army of labour, whether foreign or local, to force down wage rates. And they've been successful in doing that. Real wages have not risen in Britain for a very long time. But, of course, the ultimate problem with that is there's no demand in the economy. And the idea that we're on the mend is simply wrong. What will happen before when we have the crash? The Ukraine is about to default. Greece is possibly going to leave the euro. The housing market is absolutely pumped up completely. It's going to crash. And nobody wanted to talk about that. Certainly Miliband didn't want to talk about it. Didn't want to talk about it at all, because it's too scary. Who wants to face that fact? The banking system is still insolvent. It's been insolvent for 5 years. It remains insolvent. Who's talking about it? Nobody.
It's very, very robust, actually. It keeps going almost whatever happens, the banking system.
Well, it keeps going until it doesn't.
And they can always make up a bit more money, can't they?
No, well, they can't, because ultimately, you saw what happened when they tried to raise interest rates in the US 18 months ago. There was an immediate swoon in the markets. This is a house of cards, absolute house of cards, and it's going to collapse. And in many ways, having a Tory majority government holding the ball, when it collapses, then everybody's going to see,
Michael,
where we're going and what
Michael,
it's really
finally,
all about.
From what Martin's saying there, probably the main point is this business about demand. He's saying, well, look, actually, by cutting the public sector so massively, it's cut demand. Many businesses are finding that there's just not the demand for their goods, and that's one of the reasons we've seen falling prices.
Well, supply and demand is one of the keystones of any economy, isn't it?
This is deflation. This is a weird one, isn't it?
It is weird, you know, and I'd never actually heard the term before. I'd never heard deflation. I thought we was bimbling along quite nicely on 1 or 2%, which isn't acceptable. I mean, I can remember when inflation went up to 20% when I was a teenager. And that was under a Labour administration as well.
Well, it actually peaked. It actually peaked under the Tories.
Ah, right. Okay.
Anyway, let's get
on.
That was the era when inflation was acceptable. We've squeezed inflation out of the system, but the danger now is asset price bubbles and collapses like we had before the Keynesian welfare state was created.
Okay,
let's go. I think you'll find in Europe there are parties on the right, like the Front National in France and Fidesz in Hungary, who actually share my analysis of the economy, even though they're on the right. Yeah.
Anyway,
things are starting to open up.
I won't shed a tear about Greece leaving the euro. I want the euro zone to collapse.
Well, okay. But do you want the banking system in the City of London to collapse?
No, I think that they will always find a way to protect themselves. But countries like Greece and Italy and probably Spain should not be linked with the northern European economies. Now, I'm not an economist. Okay, I only go by what I learn myself. But the two economies are so out of kilter that trying to bring them together is always and will always be impossible.
Well, okay. I tend to agree with that, but I still come back to the fundamental problem is in the financial services sector. And when it crashes, you see, something like a Greek exit will lead to a situation where the derivatives market may just go pop. Hmm. And that means that things like RBS, which are still making a loss, go right down the drain, taking everybody's savings with it.
So if the euro goes, Martin, will it hit us in the pound? Are we insulated?
Of course it will. We're living next door. Somebody's house next door burns down, you've got the danger of catching fire yourself, haven't you?
Anyway, let's go back to the Queen now and hear a little bit more of her pronouncement to the nation.
Measures will be brought forward to help working people by greatly increasing the provision of free childcare. Legislation will be introduced to support home ownership and give housing association tenants the chance to own their own home. Measures will be introduced to increase energy security and to control immigration. My government will bring forward legislation to reform trade unions and to protect essential public services against strikes. To give new opportunities to the most disadvantaged, my government will expand the Troubled Families Programme and continue to reform welfare, with legislation encouraging employment by capping benefits and requiring young people to earn or learn. Legislation will be brought forward to improve schools and give every child the best start in life, with new powers to take over failing and coasting schools and create more academies. In England, my government will secure the future of the National Health Service by implementing the National Health Service's own five-year plan, by increasing the health budget, integrating health care and social care, and ensuring the National Health Service works on a seven-day basis. Measures will be introduced to improve access to general practitioners and to mental health care.
Yeah, so that's another section of the Queen's speech, Michael. What do you make of that? A couple of things in there that stuck out for me.
Well,
one is housing associations selling off, and the other is trade union laws to make it more difficult for them to strike in public services.
Well, the housing association thing, I mean, that goes back to Thatcher's right to buy. And I think that, you know, both issues have its own merits, because aspiration is the most important thing for anybody. You know, I actually bought my house under my council house under the first right to buy scheme, and that put me on the property ladder, to which I wouldn't be here today. So I've worked hard, paid my taxes, and I own my own home, and I think that is something that everybody should aspire to.
Martin?
Well, the point is, of course, that but in order to buy your own home, you were given a massive subsidy by the government. In other words, a welfare handout. because you didn't buy it at the price that it was the market price.
No, I didn't.
And nor will the people in the tenant. So in other words, the government, which is claims to be a free market government, is going to intervene in non-government institutions, tell them what they're going to do, tell them they've got to sell off their own stock to existing tenants at a loss, and then they will have to compensate the housing associations for that loss. So in other words, those lucky people who will buy their own houses under this will be given a handout by the government of several tens of thousands of pounds each. Meanwhile, we're saying we've got to cut people's disability payments, and they can't have an extra bedroom if they're on benefits. It's handing out bribes to certain sections of the electorate, big bribes, not even small bribes, big bribes, and other people being told to go and jump in the lake.
There is another aspect to this, Michael, and that is that the social housing stock has been falling and falling. And the problem is, if you couldn't get your council house or social housing in the first place, then you wouldn't have the right to buy it. And nowadays, it would have been very, very difficult for you to actually get a place like that.
No, you're absolutely right. And I can't disagree with some of the points that Martin's made. But it is just so important that people do have an aspiration. I don't dispute what you say. How can you? You know, the whole thing is designed to create a capitalist society where people own their own home.
Through government subsidy.
Well, through government subsidy.
Nothing to do with the free market.
Yeah. Okay,
social engineering. Basically.
We'll leave the Queen for a minute. The UK government will soon be able to track your internet activity more than ever before. Now, this is basically the
Snooper's Charter.
Snooper's Charter is back with a vengeance. Effectively, what the Snooper's Charter is doing is it's bringing back into legality a lot of the GCHQ, the spies, criminal activity, where they have been stealing our data and information about us without going to a court to get a court order to do it. So they've been putting us under surveillance illegally and criminally, and that's now being brought in this session of Parliament back into the legality again. Also, staying on the subject of GCHQ, is a really shocking story in the Express, Daily Express on Saturday. Paedophile Freemason ran Masonic Lodge up at GCHQ. This is Keith Harding, apparently, a former membership secretary of the Paedophile Information Exchange, was the worshipful master of the Mercurius Lodge in Cheltenham, known as the Spies Lodge. Now, this we've had over the years, Michael, we had the trade unions told you're not allowed to organise at GCHQ in Cheltenham. They were basically, the trade unions were stripped out, and yet we've still got these Masonic lodges in there. It just doesn't seem right.
Well, that's,
and the guy's a paedophile.
Yeah, that is a big question. The unfortunate thing is when anything negative comes up about the Freemasons, it makes a really big story. What I don't think the public realise is the millions and millions of pounds that are processed through charities by the Freemasons. And, you know, it's very, very unfortunate that sort of thing happens. You know, the guy that shot all those kids in Dunblane, he was a Freemason.
Mm. In the same lodge as Robertson. Robertson had signed his firearm certificate because it was the head of the
Agent. George Robertson, yeah. Martin, what would you make of this? Because this is, the trade unions are told you're not allowed to have a union chapel, you're not allowed to have a union meeting, but there's a Freemason spy who is the master of a Masonic lodge at GCHQ.
Well, I mean, it's come out fairly clearly now because the Kinkora Boys Home is going to be included in the investigation into all of this, that the intelligence services have been using paedophilia as a means of blackmailing political figures for decades, and that's the real scandal underlying all of this. And of course, that then you say, well, should these intelligence organisations, which have been using paedophilia as a tool, should they get more powers to spy on people? And my answer would be no. They need to be dismantled and reorganised.
What's your answer on the major point there about the Snooper's Charter?
The Snooper's Charter, I think we've got to look at this in the modern age. You know, we have very, very clever, skilled terrorist organisations that are doing all kinds of things with the internet and electronic media. And we have got to combat this some way. And to do that, there will be a price to pay, and it might be a little bit of freedom.
Okay, Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, UKIP councillor for Hengrave. You just heard there Michael Frost. After the Murdoch News, Cuba, then the Palestine connection.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.